Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, if this sounds a little odd to you, the last 2 hours you might have been catching here and there a lot of ambient noise in the background, and I had mentioned several times that we're broadcasting from the 62nd Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And now today it sounds like I'm from the studio. That's exactly the way it is. We have been pre-recording the first 2 hours of Issues Etc. from the 62nd Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod here in St. Louis, and then playing those as our first 2 hours here on Issues Etc., and doing our third hour live here from the studio. It works out a little better guest-wise and traffic-wise for us in that regard, and that's why it sounds a little bit different here in the third hour of Issues Etc. Before we get into this third hour, I would like to mention one of our loyal listeners, Nick Sandman, and he likes to say hi to everyone who listens to our sister station in KNGN, McCook, Nebraska. He's a delegate to the 62nd Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod from the McCook Circuit, and our sister station, KNGN, is located up there. Nick Sandman would like to say hello to everybody back there in the McCook Circuit. The lineup in this hour, we're going to start out with a conversation I had a little earlier today with David Van Beem of Time Magazine. You might have read this article. It's on the very recent story of the Portland Archdiocese of the Catholic Church announcing bankruptcy. The article that David wrote was called Chapter 11, Verse 1. We'll hear that in just a moment. A little bit later in this hour, Patty Skane will join us, Executive Director of Missouri Right to Life. Friday last week, a federal judge ruled that the Missouri ban on partial birth abortion is unconstitutional. That means, as we'll find out in that interview, that means that this law is not only temporarily on hold, it's on hold until it probably makes it to the Supreme Court for an up or down decision there. The Missouri ban on partial birth abortion. We'll talk with Patty Skane about that. Then we're going to be hearing some audio from the debate on both sides of the federal marriage amendment. People in favor, people against, here in the third hour of Issues Etc. And a little bit later, Peter Sprague, Senior Director of Policy Studies for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., will join us to talk about the federal marriage amendment, why it is necessary. It seems as though everything is accelerated, everything's bigger nowadays. We just don't debate debate marriage amendments. We just don't talk about gay marriage. It all goes straight to the top right away. Now, earlier this afternoon, I had the opportunity to talk with senior religion writer for Time Magazine, David Van Beem, about a story he had written for Time called Chapter 11, Verse 1. Let's listen to this interview earlier with David. First of all, I don't know if you're responsible for it, but that's a brilliant title for this piece.
I'm not. I wish I had been, but I'm glad that somebody here was.
What has happened in the Portland Archdiocese of the Catholic Church?
Well, like a lot of dioceses, it's being sued by people who are claiming to have been abused by priests there, priests or priests. But what appears to have happened is, first of all, it's small. It's a small archdiocese, so they claim not to have that much money to begin with. They are facing a suit by plaintiffs, or were facing a suit by plaintiffs, who did not seem inclined to settle. They're claiming that they're alleging that a priest abused over 50 people, and he said some rather very disturbing things during a deposition. He died in 2002, but they're ticked off, and it looked like they were going to go the whole route, and the damages that they were demanding came to $155 million, which was more than the archbishop there apparently thought that the archdiocese could pay. He also claimed that he had been quote unquote abandoned by his insurance companies, which is becoming somewhat more frequent, especially in cases where the insurance companies feel that that the facts show that beyond merely overlooking abuse by a priest, that the diocese that they were insuring actually knew enough or should have known enough to anticipate it.
Now, have they already have their financial position compromised, if you will, or paid out?
Yeah.
Some of these settlements to priestly abuse victims?
Yes, they've already paid us $53 million. They are claiming, or the Archbishop is claiming, that the diocese is only worth $50 million at this point. One of the issues that will be taken up, assuming that the bankruptcy goes forward in a way that you would expect it to, is the question of whether the diocese's worth includes the worth of donations to and property of the parishes. And that's a real sticking point. If it were to, then its worth would go up to something. The plaintiffs claim that its worth would go up to $300 million. All bishops who have, or at least the majority of bishops who found themselves in similar situations, have stated that you can't count that wealth. It's not seizable. It's not really part of the wealth of the diocese, and that's something that the bankruptcy judge in this case may have the opportunity to decide, and that could prove to be a very important precedent.
That's what I was curious about, because an archdiocese, even a small one like Portland, is obviously not just a central office and the staff of the archbishop and the assets of the immediate diocese itself, but at least in the way that it appears that the Roman Catholic Church operates financially in normal times, the schools, the perhaps universities, of course the parishes and their properties, aren't they usually considered to be, at least in some sense, the property of the archdiocese, assets upon which they could, say, borrow or do other kind of financial transactions?
To be honest, I don't know what the history of that is, or in terms of people who have borrowed against it. I do think that canon law, according to canon law, they're separate. So there may be some question of is canon law honored in the case of a bankruptcy that the diocese has voluntarily entered into.
I read in your story that if the judge were to decide that the assets were broader than what the archbishop seems to be arguing, that it would still be the archbishop's choice as to whether or not to shut down any institutions that may be part of the sale?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that the judge can say, well, you have to pay out such and such amount of money, or the judge can force the arbitration to the point where it's either get out of bankruptcy and face the lawsuits, or it's pay X amount of money on the dollar claimed. How the archbishop is supposed to come up with that money is up to the archbishop. And my point was that this is not going to be, at least straightforwardly, a case of the judge of a mean, nasty civil judge reaching out and shutting down parishes. Whatever decisions along those lines are made will first of all be taken by the archbishop, and then be carried out by the archbishop. But the pressure on him is going to be being told that you owe such and such monies.
We're talking about last week's bankruptcy announcement by the Portland Archdiocese. David Van Bima is our guest. He's senior religion writer for Time magazine, author of a story in Time titled Chapter 11, Verse 1. And you can read that article on the web at time.com, time.com. David, has the bankruptcy route been attempted by other archdioceses in the last 3 years since the Priestley scandal broke?
No, it hasn't been attempted. And as far as we know, then Boston Archbishop Cardinal Law went to Rome and asked permission, or came very close, asked permission a little bit indirectly to enter bankruptcy, to take the Boston Archdiocese into bankruptcy, and was extremely firmly discouraged. So one of two things has happened. Actually, I amend that, one of three things. There's a possibility that the Archbishop, Portland Archbishop, got permission from somebody other than the people who had been denying it to Law, in which case there's going to be some butting of heads in the Vatican. There's a possibility that the Vatican has decided really to switch fields on this and allow somebody to try bankruptcy, and there's a possibility that Archbishop Flosny did not actually get permission from the sort of authorities who could give it.
Seems like one of those, all three of those really are intriguing, but the one in which he didn't get permission, what kind of a position would that put the bishop in then?
That would put him, I would imagine, in a very awkward position, because if my understanding, or rather my understanding from our Vatican correspondent, is that you are supposed to ask permission if you are engaged in an expenditure of either more than $3 or more than $6 million. I'm unclear on which it is. And if he went ahead with this without doing that, then I imagine that that folks would be very displeased. How that displeasure would actually be communicated, it would probably be communicated somehow or other through the papal nuncio here, but I don't know what it might amount to.
Is this the first of others, or perhaps the first of many, attempts at bankruptcy, given the fact that this seems to be endemic across the Archdiocese of the United States?
The Diocese of Tucson, Arizona, has been talking about possible bankruptcy for some time, and I believe after Portland announced, continued to talk about it. When I asked Mark Chapko, who's a counsel for the Catholic Conference, whether he thought a lot of people would follow suit, he said that he it was sort of a desperate measure, but he thought that there might be a handful of dioceses that were desperate enough to try it out. If you find yourself in a position where you don't have enough money to pay what you think you're going to have to be, you know, what you're being sued, what you think a jury will award your plaintiffs, then you have to do something to rationalize your debt. However, so one can understand why some dioceses would feel that this is one of the only options open to them. On the other hand, there are so many pitfalls and unknowns involved with bankruptcy that I would imagine that other than the handful that feel so very desperate about this that they have to act quickly, that everybody else who's even halfway considering it will hang back and just to see what happens and how it works itself out. I mean, it's conceivable that this will turn out to be the smartest thing that the Portland Archdiocese could have done. It's also conceivable that it will, you know, blow up in their face.
David Van Bima is author of a story in Time magazine titled Chapter 11, Verse 1, about last week's bankruptcy announcement by the Portland Archdiocese of the Roman Catholic Church. He's also a senior religion writer for Time magazine. David, thank you for being our guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, you probably saw also this as you were looking through the news. This was in Saturday's paper, that's where I got this one. Judge overturns Missouri ban on partial birth abortion. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk with Patty Skane, a regular guest here on the program, and executive director of Missouri Right to Life, about the decision on Friday by a federal judge. And that was last week, that the Missouri's ban on partial birth abortion is unconstitutional. Now, I began by asking Patty about this law in Missouri called the Missouri Infants Protection Act. Here's what she had to say.
Of course, our law, and it's one of the reasons very frustrating with the judge's decision is frustrating, because our law is clearly, or tries to clearly differentiate between abortion that would be impacted by the Roe v. Wade decision and an infanticide procedure. We try to, through definitions of the and descriptions of the procedure, to differentiate those two things, and therefore felt that the, of course, health exception was not needed, because there isn't any health reason for infanticide. And the AMA clearly, through the entire process of Congress trying to ban this procedure, has said that there is no medical condition that where this type of procedure would be the best thing to use, and actually can, in many instances, and it's believed by a number of people that it's actually harmful to the woman to do this kind of procedure.
Patty, the judge did cite the Supreme Court's decision regarding a Nebraska law and partial birth abortion. What was the judge's reasoning here?
Well, he just drew similarities between our law and the Nebraska law, and then said that, well, we're trying to outlaw the same type of procedure, and therefore the U.S. Supreme Court has said it's unconstitutional to do that, and he used that reasoning. But he did not recognize that our law is written differently than the Nebraska law, and that it tries to differentiate, between the abortion procedure versus an infanticide procedure. I think the law that we passed is written differently, intentionally. It's just a matter of us learning through experience, you know, the different ways we have to do things to get the courts to recognize things a certain way. And so through experience, we learned that we needed a more specific definition of the procedure. And so our law is written differently than the Nebraska law, but the judge failed to recognize that.
The president of Planned Parenthood of the St. Louis region, Paula Giannino, said in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today of the judge's ruling on Friday, "Today's ruling is a victory for women and women's health. We are relieved and grateful that the court was able to see through this dangerous and deceptive bill." Your response?
Well, of course, we know, as I said before, when we were going through the whole process in 99, and actually it's been even before that at the federal level, we have had numerous doctors testify, including opinions from the AMA, that there is no medical condition where this procedure would be needed and, in fact, is actually harmful to women. So the very fact that they're talking about a victory for women, and it's not a victory for women because they're using this procedure on women for late-term abortions to guarantee that the baby is not fully out of the mom before it dies, and that it's not a victory for women. It's just the opposite.
What happens now with this Missouri law?
Well, the Missouri law now will have to be appealed. That process is something that will be taken by the Missouri Attorney General. That's his job, to appeal Missouri laws. And so he should appeal this to the Eighth Circuit, the next level of federal court. And, we, of course, obviously encourage him to do that. And that's how people can get involved, by encouraging calling the AG's office or writing letters to the Attorney General's office, and encouraging him to appeal this law, or this decision, rather.
Now, is there a possibility that Jay Nixon would not appeal this law?
Well, the Attorney General for a number of years has taken a pro-choice or pro-abortion position, and it would be something that would, I'm sure, be difficult for him politically, but because of the types of support that he gets, but it is something that it is his job to do that. I mean, regardless of what his position is on the issue, his job as Attorney General is to defend the laws of Missouri as they're passed, and so it is his job to do that. But it is something that I'm sure he would just as soon not have to do.
If he appeals the law to the Circuit Court, what do you expect the decision to be there? Do you expect this Missouri law to go to the Supreme Court? And if so, will they be able to draw the distinction that you made early in this conversation between the Nebraska law that they struck down and the Missouri law?
Well, we have some reason. We're not surprised by Judge Wright's decision. He has a history of finding in this way on abortion regulation type laws, and so it's not a surprise that he continues that trend. But we have had good abortion decisions out of the Eighth Circuit, and so we have, I think, more hope that we will get a good decision out of the Eighth Circuit, and hopefully also out of the U.S. Supreme Court, should it go that far. Of course, you also have the federal court cases going on at the same time here now.
The Missouri governor's race is coming up here in November this year. Give us a brief rundown of the candidates and their positions vis-a-vis the life issue.
Well, of course, you have the two Democrat pro-abortion candidates. Claire McCaskill and Bob Holden, who are running against each other. We have endorsed and are supporting Jim LePage, who is a pro-life Democrat and running against them. He has a difficult battle trying to get enough votes to oust them both, but we're hoping that that can be done. And, of course, then in the Republican ticket, we have endorsed Matt Blunt for governor.
Is partial birth abortion, is it good for women?
Well, the medically, the AMA and numerous physician groups have said no, it's not, that medically it is not good for them. It's a procedure that was devised to use on later term abortions to guarantee that that what happened years ago with a later term abortion is that the baby oftentimes survived the abortion. And that was a very difficult thing to have to deal with then, because of course once the baby is outside the mom's body, it's born and it's illegal to harm it or kill it, etc. And so this is a way to guarantee that the baby was dead before it came totally out of the mom. And so there is no medical reason for forcing a birth, and that's exactly what this is. It's a forced birth of this child, feet first, and then when the head is still in the mom, then they puncture the back of the skull and suck the brain out. And there's no medical reason for that to be done. It's actually physically harmful to the mom to force a birth before she's ready for that whole process to start.
Patty Skain, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc., and please keep up the good work. That's Patty Skain, Executive Director of Missouri Right to Life. We talked earlier about that Friday ruling by a federal judge, that was last week, that Missouri's ban on partial birth abortion is unconstitutional. We shall continue to watch that story on that law, and I imagine it will give us something to talk about for, well, years to come. If you'd like to visit Missouri Right to Life on the web, their address, missourilife.org, missourilife.org, or call them at area code 573-635-5110. That's 573, area code 635-5110. When we come back from this break, we will hear, I have a little bit of audio for you, both against and for the federal marriage amendment. It looks like it's headed for defeat today, probably tomorrow on a procedural vote in the U.S. Senate. Maybe dead for the year. We might not see more, at least legislative debate on the federal marriage amendment for what? Well, at least until after the presidential election. We'll find out whether or not it becomes an issue in the presidential election. And then after we hear some of that audio, we'll talk with Peter Sprague, Senior Director of Policy Studies for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., about the federal marriage amendment, get the details, really, and find out if it doesn't make it through the Senate today or tomorrow, as it's not expected to do, when will we have a federal marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution? That's coming up after this break. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll hear both against and for the federal marriage amendment after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Life, could it exist on Mars?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the editors and writers for Creation Magazine. Ken, there's been a lot of news recently about the search for life on Mars. Now, do you think there ever could be life on planets like Mars?
Well, from a Christian perspective, the Bible doesn't say whether there is or is not animal or plant life on other planets. But because the Earth was created first and the sun, moon and stars were made for signs and seasons for the Earth, I suspect God only created life on this planet. Also, the Bible tells us that the Earth is for the children of men and the heavens are the Lord's. This again seems to indicate life was created specially here on Earth. We do know that there can't be any other races of people on other planets. You see, Adam's sin brought death and destruction to the whole universe, and only Adam's race can be saved, as Jesus stepped into history to become a man to pay the penalty for our sin. If there was another race of beings in the universe, they'd suffer from the effects of Adam's sin, but they couldn't be saved, as Jesus became a man to save only Adam's race. Personally, I believe that the millions, even billions of dollars being spent by NASA and other agencies around the world in a desperate attempt to find life on Mars or other planets is just a waste of money and time. If they didn't believe in evolution, they wouldn't waste all this money.
If Adam was the first man, how do we explain all the different people groups or races around the world? Ken Ham provides answers from both science and scripture in his free booklet, available at answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Should you allow your children to watch television news? It depends on their age and level of maturity, but keep in mind the news can be frightening. According to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the crime rate has decreased in recent years. Yet the reporting of crime in the news has increased 240%. This can make the world seem like a very scary place. Remember that all news is not appropriate for all children. But if your children are frightened by the news, encourage them to talk about it. Remind them that Jesus loves them and that He is always with them to protect and defend them. Nothing can ever pull them away from His loving arms. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis is an underwriter of Issues Etc. Hope Lutheran is located at 5218 Neosho in St. Louis. Randy Asbury and Stephen Rosebrock are the pastors. Their phone number, 314-352-0014, 352-0014. Hope Lutheran Church and School in St. Louis, www.hopelutheranstl.org, www.hopelutheranstl.org. Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, as we speak, and this will probably be a foregone conclusion by tomorrow sometime, the Federal Marriage Amendment, which was being discussed and debated in the U.S. Senate, is headed toward defeat. According to the Reuters story, the latest, and this is just a couple hours old, President Bush, his bid to amend the Constitution to ban same-sex marriage headed toward defeat on Tuesday, with the Democratic foe John Kerry accusing him of divisive election year politics. Proponents scrambled to win the support of half of the 100-member Senate, but both sides said the measure seemed certain to be blocked on a procedural vote Wednesday. That's tomorrow. If it's mostly Republican backers are unable to get 60 votes to end debate and move to a vote for passage, the proposal will likely be dead for the year, but proponents vowed to try again next year. Now, polls show that most Americans oppose same-sex marriage, but they do split pretty evenly on whether or not the constitutional ban is required and needed. Surveys also find voters believe a host of other issues are far more important than a federal marriage ban, such as health care, education, national security. Now, it will undoubtedly be an issue for the presidential campaign, but right now, let's hear from people on both sides of the Federal Marriage Amendment. This, again, is an actual amendment to the Constitution. It would change the wording of the Constitution itself, be the 28th Amendment, if it were to go through, of the U.S. Constitution, and it would define marriage as a man and woman. First, an opponent, Joan Gary, executive director of Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, says a constitutional ban on gay marriage would be discriminatory.
President Bush threw down the gauntlet when he proposed this constitutional amendment, and I think he miscalculated badly. That fair-minded Americans, including the Senate of the United States, I think are wondering how he could even be considering an amendment that writes discrimination into the Constitution.
You know, there are other people at the same time who are asking, how could we not be considering this is a drastic measure. I don't think anyone says this is something that's done lightly, amending the U.S. Constitution. And this is a drastic measure. But what do you do when you have not only federal judges throughout the United States, individuals like city employees, say in the case of San Francisco, throughout the United States, and one state Supreme Court, Massachusetts, to be specific, that are fairly well mandating gay marriage in one form or another. Massachusetts is the thing, I think, that made this necessary. Well, she wonders how anyone could be thinking of such a thing. I wonder how being pressed to the wall like this on the issue of gay marriage, how we cannot be considering doing this. Would I like to see something other than the Constitution amended if there were another way? Of course. Because every time we amend the Constitution, every time we amend it, we open up the possibility it could be amended the other direction, you know. We have had amendments that have been overturned. And I am a little worried that 25 years from now, this amendment would be overturned to say, no, we're going to flip it around. But at least at this point, it doesn't seem like there's any other way out of this. Now, Senator Bill Frist, he says marriage itself is too important to be defined only by the courts.
Before we ever embark on an untested social experiment on children, we need to have a public debate. And an appropriate representative place to do that is on the floor of the United States Senate.
Now, it doesn't appear the Senate is going to be the place where this thing gets legs right now, but Senator Bill Frist makes a point, and this is one I've heard other senators make as well, in particular Senator Santorum most recently. I was listening on the radio. They're talking about this amendment being something to benefit and to save children. The case is, look, if we redefine marriage, we are essentially saying that children in this country don't need a mom and a dad, and that the optimal situation for children in this country is not a mother and a father, but any arrangement you want to come up with. I think that's a very strong point. It may have rhetorical force, but I think it actually has the force of logic behind it, too. If we say that a man and a woman, and that is what marriage is, a man and a woman, if we say that that is not the optimal situation for children, then we open the door for any situation to prevail in the household where children are present. Now, Bishop George McKinney of the Church of God in Christ says that gay marriage is far more than simply a political issue.
The outcome of this debate is far more important than the outcome of this year's elections. Yes. And will be remembered long after the next election is over.
Yes. Now, Bishop McKinney is just the first we're going to hear from. Here is Rabbi Yitzchak Sladowski of the Rabbinical Board of Queens, New York. He says that the courts are wrong to declare a right of gay marriage.
It was the prophet Isaiah in chapter 5, verse 20, who said, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil."
Now, I'll have to say this. There are lots of other people who are between Rabbi Sladowski and someone we're going to hear from in just a few minutes from the Roman Catholic Church. That would be Monsignor William Fay. Between the people that we're going to hear here, these two men are most bold to simply come out and say what we're talking about here is an issue of good and evil. Now, the rabbi put it very plainly. If we do this, if we allow gay marriage, we are calling evil good and good evil. Now, the proponents of gay marriage say, no, we're not calling marriage bad. We're trying to allow other people to have an in, people who are not necessarily men and women, but maybe men and women, to have an in on the good of marriage. Well, if everything is good, then nothing is good. Good is only known as it's differentiated from bad, right? If everything is good, then nothing is good. Now, here in just about 10 minutes, we're going to be hearing from Peter Sprague, a senior director of policy studies for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., and getting some of the details both on the federal marriage amendment and on what's going on in the Senate today and tomorrow. Before we get there, here's the Reverend Walter Fountroy, a civil rights leader. He says that children need both a mother and a father.
Marriage between a man and a woman performs two very essential functions for civil society. First, that of procreation, and secondly that of socialization. And I believe that it is not fair or logical to reward persons with the title marriage who cannot perform the task.
I haven't heard that one before either. To award persons with the title of marriage who cannot fulfill the task. You see, and I think he makes a good point. Marriage is not only an institution, a human institution in society, it is a task. It is a responsibility. This is why it is legally recognized as something that has certain obligations attached to it. Usually in law, we simply recognize the obligations that are legal and financial that are attached to marriage, right? A man and a woman, when they marry, agree to a certain arrangement between the two of them that's legally recognized. That's not all marriage is. But in the eyes of the state, that's all the state really cares about. They don't care whether you love each other. The state has no interest in whether or not you love your spouse. They do have an interest in whether or not the financial and legal arrangement that is marriage between the two of you is maintained. And if it's going to be dissolved, of course, what happens when people divorce? When people divorce, they have to divide property. They have to divide assets. And they dissolve a legal relationship. And after they're divorced and the decree is final, except for alimony, child payments, things like that, there's nothing connecting them legally any longer. The husband can't come back, the ex can't come back and say, hey, you're still married to me. You see, there's a task to be performed in marriage. And I think it's a compelling argument made there by that civil rights leader that if people are not able, and the procreation of children, of course, is also a task that brings us the next generation of Americans. If they can't perform that task, should we reward them with the name or the title of marriage? Here's Monsignor William Fay. I mentioned him before. He's General Secretary of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. He comes straight to the point. He says Roman Catholic bishops support a constitutional ban on gay marriage.
The Church believes and teaches that marriage is created by God. The Church believes that marriage is a faithful, exclusive, lifelong, and loving union of a man and a woman who are the foundation of the family unit, which itself is the bedrock of society.
You very seldom find, I always just find this a little interesting, you very seldom find Protestants speaking the way that Catholics will speak here. And it's commendable. What does he say? This is what the Church teaches this. The Church recognizes marriage to be this. It recognizes marriage's role to be that in society. This is what the Church teaches. Enough said. Point made. Sad to say, there are some very prominent Roman Catholic politicians that would disagree with what the Church teaches. Here's the Reverend Jeffrey Brown of Union Baptist Church of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He says he is relieved to appear with other defenders of traditional marriage.
Fighting for children and for the definition of marriage in Massachusetts can make you feel like you're by yourself. But coming down to Washington, D.C., and seeing this cloud of witnesses makes me feel like I want to keep going.
And that's encouraging because the fight ahead is going to be difficult. If the news is to be believed, we'll see tomorrow this federal marriage amendment take a dive in the Senate. Smart people say it's dead for the year. That means we wait until after the presidential election to see it again, at least in an official form. I wonder, as quick as things are going in our society today, will the novelty wear off and we're not going to be worried about it come 6 months from now? Well, you know, we fought about that before, but it's not so important now. Here's Senator Brown back, Senator Sam Brown back of Kansas. He says that he and other senators are hearing about the gay marriage issue, and they're being flooded with calls on the issue, too.
It was in a parade Friday night, and people were yelling from the sidelines, pass the marriage amendment. So the message is being heard across America, and it's being received in the halls of Congress.
And finally, Ron Innes of he's a national chairman of the Congress of Racial Equality. He makes a fine distinction here. But he says that same-sex marriage simply isn't a civil right.
While I will fight for the individual right of anyone of any particular lifestyle, I will not equate and elevate to the same moral high ground that we had in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s.
That's Roy Innes of the National, he's the National Chairman of the Congress of Racial Equality. Now, this has been said before because this is one of the arguments that's being made in favor of gay marriage. Well, we had laws against interracial marriage, and part of the civil rights battle was to have those laws declared unconstitutional or overturned, right? So the proponents of gay marriage say all we're doing is carrying on the fight of the civil rights movement. The last frontier was interracial marriage. We'll desegregate marriage. Well, the next frontier is gay marriage, and we'll desegregate it there. Roy Innes says, no, it doesn't rise to the moral high ground of the civil rights movement. We're joined here for the last few minutes of Issues Etc. by Peter Sprague. He's Senior Director of Policy Studies for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. He joins us to talk about the Federal Marriage Amendment. Peter, welcome back to Issues Etc. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, tell us about the amendment. What does it consist of? Because sometimes when we hear about a constitutional amendment, we think about big, gigantic volumes, paper after paper, complicated legal documents. What is this amendment?
Well, it's really only two sentences long, so it's really quite simple. The first sentence just says marriage in the United States shall, quote it exactly, but marriage in the United States shall be defined as only the union of one man and one woman. So that would define civil marriage for every level of government, federal, state, and local, in every part of the country. The second sentence says, neither this Constitution, meaning the federal Constitution, nor the Constitution of any state shall be construed to require that marriage or the benefits or incidents of marriage, the legal benefits and incidents of marriage, be given to unmarried couples or groups. That part is designed to rein in the courts from ordering the benefits of marriage to be granted to unmarried couples, such as happened in Vermont with the Vermont civil unions, which were adopted only because that state's Supreme Court put a gun to their heads, basically. So it has that twofold purpose, to fix the definition of marriage nationwide and to rein in the courts with respect to the benefits of marriage.
As we speak, the Senate is considering this for a vote. Give us the latest status in the Senate of the Federal Marriage Amendment.
Well, the Senate began debating this on Friday. They continued yesterday and today. Now, I've been traveling today, actually, so I have not gotten an update today from our people who actually monitor the events on the Hill. But it was scheduled for a vote tomorrow, so I believe that's still going to take place. Now, there have been some media reports that, going back to that, the description of the amendment, some people find that second sentence, which relates to reigning in the courts with respect to civil unions or domestic partnerships, they find that second sentence confusing. So there's been some talk about dropping the second sentence and just having it as a definition of marriage amendment. And in that case, the Democrats have said they will perhaps not abide by their agreement to allow a straight up or down vote on the amendment. So there is a little bit of parliamentary maneuvering that's taking place over what amendment will be voted upon and how, but we certainly hope that the Senate will vote on this amendment so that people can know where their elected representatives stand.
Now, according to Reuters, this is the latest, and this is about a couple hours old. They say that tomorrow it's expected to die in procedural vote, given the lack of the ability of the Republican backers of it to get 60 votes in a 100-seat U.S. Senate. What are your realistic expectations?
Well, we would have been pleasantly surprised. I'll say that if we had gotten 67 votes, which is the two-thirds margin required to ratify a constitutional amendment, we did not count that many votes as being on our side, but we want to really bring this debate to the fore, and we're not going to give up, even if we fail this week in the Senate. The House is expected to vote later this fall. And this will be a continuing issue. It'll be an issue in the elections this fall, and it will be an issue in the Congress to come, I'm sure.
Peter, I'd like you to react to something that Joan Gary of Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Discrimination had to say. She says a constitutional ban on gay marriage would be discriminatory.
President Bush threw down the gauntlet when he proposed this constitutional amendment, and I think he miscalculated badly. That fair-minded Americans, including the Senate of the United States, I think, are wondering how he could even be considering an amendment that writes discrimination into the Constitution.
Your reaction?
Well, it's not a question of discrimination. It's a question of the definition of marriage. And we believe that the male-female union is an essential characteristic of what marriage is. That's what it's been through all of our history. It's what it's been in every culture, every society, every religion in human history. And so it's not a question of discrimination. It's a question of definition. And the definition of marriage requires a man and a woman.
It seems as though the proponents of gay marriage and legalizing gay marriage, formalizing gay marriage, seem to be assuming access to the institution of marriage that is being blocked somehow, rather than, they seem to be framing it that way, rather than saying we're asking for marriage to be redefined as something other than a man or a woman.
Well, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. The two sides not only disagree in principle, but disagree in how to define the issue. And as I said, we believe this is a question of the definition of marriage. They say it's about access to marriage and that they're being denied access to this public institution of marriage. But strictly speaking, they have the same access as anyone else, but subject to the same restrictions. No one has an unlimited choice of marital partner under the law. No one is allowed to marry a small child or a close blood relative or a person who is already married or a person of the same sex. Even if we were to do away with the restriction on marrying someone of the same sex, there would still be restrictions on your choice of marital partner. So it's really not a question of access. It's a question of whether these restrictions on access are essential to the definition of marriage, and we believe they are.
Even if there is a federal marriage amendment, say, to ban gay marriage, a larger issue seems to exist. We spoke recently with a guest who says, look, what we really need to do is rein in the courts, and we need to tell, in particular, the Supreme Court, through the actual legislature of the United States, that DOMA, Defense Against Marriage, Defense of Marriage Act, that was signed into law, that is off limits to the courts. They cannot hear cases regarding that. I think there's even a bill that's pending up there on that. What do you make of the idea?
Well, we think that's a good idea in principle to rein in the courts through what's been called jurisdictional limitation legislation, and there is provision in the Constitution which gives Congress the right to define the jurisdiction of the appellate courts. But that would set up really a constitutional showdown with the Supreme Court, which, given the role that the court has assumed in society today, I don't think it's clear that Congress would win that. I think only a constitutional amendment, only with a constitutional amendment can we securely overrule the U.S. Supreme Court.
So in other words, you could pass a bill that would put DOMA off limits to the courts. It will be challenged, of course, and then the Supreme Court gets to hear a case basically deciding how far it wants its jurisdiction to go.
Right. And what do you do if the Supreme Court says, issues a ruling saying that under the Constitution, our jurisdiction over constitutional questions, which they would treat it as, cannot be limited? Then you have Congress saying one thing, you have this court saying another, and you have a constitutional crisis. Whereas I think if we write the definition of marriage into the Constitution, then there's nothing the court can do about it.
All right, then, Peter, with the last few minutes we have left to us, let's say for the sake of argument that tomorrow this procedural vote kills the federal marriage amendment in the Senate. What happens next, and can we expect to see it come back?
We can certainly expect to see it come back. It's going to come back, as I mentioned, probably in the House later this year, in the House of Representatives. And even if it's unsuccessful there, we will expect to see it come back in the next Congress. As long as, until the homosexual activists abandoned their attempt to rewrite our marriage laws through the courts, and that's what's really started this battle, is the this wave of litigation demanding same-sex marriage. Unless they were to abandon that, we will not abandon the effort to protect marriage through the Constitution.
Peter, is it too late? Should our listeners continue to call their senators tonight and tomorrow morning?
Absolutely. You should continue to call the Senate offices tonight and tomorrow morning of your United States senators, your two U.S. senators for your state. And the calls have been coming in this week, according to the reports I've heard, and it's caused problems with the phone system. So if you don't get through the first time, keep trying. And if you don't reach them, you can try the Washington office. If it doesn't work there, try their state offices. But definitely let them know how you feel.
Peter Sprague is Senior Director of Policy Studies for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Thank you for giving us your time, Peter.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Peter Sprague. Now, if you'd like to visit the Family Research Council, you can do so on the web. Very simple website, frc.org. FRC, Family Research Council, frc.org. Or you can always call them at area code 202-393-2100. Area code 202-393-2100. Now, this is not going to go away. This is not something that you can just say, okay, I heard the news about the federal marriage amendment, and it's going to be out of the news probably tomorrow by the end of the week. They'll go on to other things. This is not something that's going to go away, because gay marriage and the advocates for gay marriage are not going to go away. They're not going to stop saying, you're blocking our access to an institution. And they're not going to come out and say, we're asking you to redefine marriage. No one who advocates for this kind of radical novel change ever says we're asking you to redefine something. They always say, we just want to be included. Well, let's see it for what it is. To advocate for gay marriage would be to redefine marriage itself. And as much as it pains me to say so, if it takes a definition of marriage as a man and a woman written in the U.S. Constitution to block that, then that's what it takes. Tune in tonight at 8 o'clock for the rebroadcast of today's first hour of Issues Etc. We talked to Pastor Randy Asbury of Good News Magazine. It's a great conversation we had with him there in the first hour about the forgiveness of sins. And we also discussed, is the Bible silent about abortion? And we answered that question with Dr. James Lamb of Lutherans for Life. That's tonight from 8 to 9 on AM 850 KFUO. Tomorrow on the program, broadcasting from the 62nd Regular Convention of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, we'll talk about myths regarding evangelism with Pastor Bob Ron of the Lutheran Heritage Foundation.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.